A few weeks later, one of Carvath Wells, an English-born traveler and lecturer, was speaking to the English-speaking Union in Chicago, and he came up with the idea after a very excellent lecture in which he, I think, gave as good a statement and as clear a statement of United States dependence on the resources of Asia, the reasons we can't pull out of Asia. Nevertheless, concluded when they said, "What shall we do?" with a statement, he says, "Drop the atom bomb on Moscow tomorrow. Give the Russians 24 hours notice that they are to stop doing this. If not, we're going to drop the atom bomb." Well, I don't think there could be anything more tragic for us to do than to do that. It's an illustration, I think, of the fact that in a situation such as this and in times like this, that we can't expect to run our government in the way we have tried to do it in the past without a great deal of success, but certainly we can expect less success in the future, and that is send anybody, any kind of people down to Washington and then tell them how to run it by writing letters and telegrams. Too often we are going to be stirred up momentarily in a campaign of supporting some project which is exactly the wrong thing to do. Now, maybe some of you agree with that, but I don't agree that dropping the atom bomb is going to help us. I think it would be the one thing it would demonstrate to the Asiatic world that the United States is opposed to their ever getting any better situation than they now exist. And we might, if we would drop an atom bomb, let's drop three of them, for instance. Let's drop one on Moscow. Let's drop one on the oil fields, assuming the oil fields are all in one place. Evidence now is that they aren't. And then drop another one on the atom bomb plant that they have, or their storehouse of atom bombs, if we know where that is. And suppose all three are direct hits and they're successful. What do we wake up to the next morning? Well, we have killed perhaps 300,000 men, women, and children in Russia, but there are still 199,650,000 Russians, all struggling for something better than they've had before. Most of them peasants who under the Tsars had almost nothing. Today have very little, but have more than what they had once before. Whatever leadership has been given to China in a new effort to do something for the Chinese people might have been removed. But do you think the Chinese people are all going to lie down and die? What program do we have for Russia and for China? Just to mention two places after the leaders that they now have are removed. Do we think it would be very long before other leaders arise to take their place? Have we solved anything? No, we've only created some more problems. We may have given us ourselves a few more months in which we can live a carefree existence, in which we can enjoy some of the things we have back home, but it wouldn't be peace for very long. That is no program. We are facing today the problem of trying to mobilize our forces in Europe, and we find now for the first time all of the things that we should have been doing during these past 5 years. And we begin to realize how inadequate we have been as far as our leadership is concerned in dealing with these problems that for the first time seem to be ours. Our country has basked for too many years without realizing it under the leadership and under the protection of a parent who is taking charge of the problems of the world. We've lived as children in an international house in which Britain has taken care of the rent and all of the problems of keeping the leaks out of the roof and one thing and another. And we've enjoyed a world in which we had very little responsibility. Our foreign trade has been an important part of our economic structure, and still most of our foreign trade has been carried in British ships, it's been insured in British insurance companies, it's been financed by British banks and handled by British trading houses and protected on the high seas by the British Navy. And in these countries, order has been maintained and governments have been kept orderly by the fact that there were British garrisons. And still, that has all been removed. Britain went into World War II with $9 billion of investments, which gave her income and dividends, and she had to sell all of those, and she ended up $9 billion in debt to her colonies. And she has had to withdraw as a result of that, and so there is a great vacuum of leadership. And the United States has failed to step into that leadership, into that vacuum, but Russia has stepped into the vacuum. And today we are faced with the fact that there is a great force that is moving contrary to ours, and we have yet no program to counteract it. Well, what might we do? Well, let's try to recognize perhaps what this force is. One very significant statement seems to me that it was made about this by an American businessman is something that's worth repeating to you. This is from Eugene Black, the president of the World Bank. He was formerly vice president of the Chase National Bank of New York. In his present position, he has had a chance to get a picture of the world, not only in his travels, but in the reports of his organization. And in a speech in Paris last August, he included this sentence: perhaps the most powerful single force shaping the course of history in our time is the awakening consciousness of the underprivileged masses of people that conditions of poverty, ill health, and ignorance in which they live are not preordained. What he has been saying is what a number of other people have been trying to tell us, and that is that there is a great tide, a great groundswell of revolution, that these people throughout the world who for generations have known nothing but starvation and disease and poverty, as we have advanced in our mechanical age and increased our means of communication, we have shrunken the world so that they can look over the fences and at their neighbors and find out that the conditions in which they have lived, as Mr. Black says, are not necessarily preordained. And they are struggling, therefore, they are looking for help to revolt against those conditions and to get something better. It's one thing we should do is to recognize that throughout Asia, at least, and in a good part of Africa, that most of these people have a different colored skin from ours. And therefore, it might be interesting to have a statement of the situation from one of our own citizens of a different colored skin. May I read a few sentences from Mordecai W. Johnson, the president of Howard University? Let us take this one great fact, which is perhaps the most important fact in this world and has been for the last 50 to 100 years. There have been over 1 billion people, Asiatic and Africans, who have been seething with rebellion against the political domination, economic exploitation, racial and color discrimination and humiliation that leading Western powers have perpetrated upon them in their own lands and in the lands controlled by the Western powers. They have been hungry to get out from under this political domination. They have been looking for leadership. They have had reason to believe that the United States, by reason of her history, would afford them that leadership, but we have not done so. We have been a great disappointment to them. I think that perhaps the best summary of the situation that we face over in Asia is that given by Kais Beach, a correspondent of the Chicago Daily News, in a report to his editors last May, which was written up in the paper in this way. We began to lose Asia, he says, the day we won the war, because since the war ended, we have been bucking revolutions in Asia instead of backing them. We are the most powerful nation on earth, but our great strength is our greatest weakness. We were too fat, too prosperous, too self-absorbed, too soft to face up to the harsh realities of the post-war world. We have forgotten that our own country was born of bloody rebellion against a foreign power. When the war ended, we didn't have a program for Asia. We didn't care. We were ready to write off more than 1 billion people because of our abysmal ignorance of their culture, their hopes, their aspirations. But the Russians cared, and they had a program. We had the ball when we liberated Asia, but we didn't know what to do with it, and we fumbled it, and the Russians picked it up, and they've been running with it ever since. There is this great spirit of revolution. The Russians have seized that. Under the cloak of communism, they have adopted it to advance their imperialistic designs. The United States has moved in on the other side. That we should back revolutions is an idea perhaps a little repugnant. At least it's new to the American people. But it isn't not only a wild-eyed newspaper correspondent that's made that suggestion, because in January, in an article in Look magazine, a justice of our Supreme Court, William O. Douglas, wrote under the heading, "We Can't Save Asia by War Alone," telling how this Russian prairie fire was moving down through Asia. And then he says, "The problem of reversing the trend is primarily a political as well as a military problem. It means taking over the direction of the revolutions of the world. America has special capacities for it. We ourselves are the product of revolution. By our act of revolting against colonialism and oppression, we set an example which to this day inspires the underprivileged of the world." Well, I'm not talking necessarily about a military revolution. Maybe it's got to have some of that in it, but it's got to be something more than that. We've got to find out what these people, how we can help them. And all we've offered them up to the present time is a picture of what we have here in the United States. We've gone out with moving pictures and with 15-minute broadcasts on the Voice of America and with pamphlets and with photographs to show them what a wonderful country this is, what democracy has produced in the United States, how our workmen go to their factories in cars, how our farmers have electricity and all modern conveniences on the farms, and so on. And these people who are still cultivating their grain as they did before Christ in the most primitive methods, who are barely eking out an existence, whose main concern in life is just merely to get enough to eat from day to day, who never have a meal in their whole life as good a meal as we've had here today. Take a look at that picture and they say, that's heaven, we'll take it. And the United States says, oh no, you can't come to the United States. And then Russia puts up a sign and says, main entrance to democracy. And they say, well, what have we got to lose? Let's go along with Russia. I don't think one person in 1,000 in China knows the difference between communism, socialism, and democracy. It isn't a question they can't read or write, they can't understand it. It's just a question of a full belly and a warm back. And somebody who's willing to come in and help them is somebody that they will go along with. I know that's what it is in Greece. I know that's why we had the guerrilla-inspired civil war there, because the Greeks are the poorest prospects for communism in the world. They're the most democratic people. They gave us the word democracy. They gave us the concept of democracy. And today, they are the most democratic people. Every one of them thinks he ought to be prime minister. That's why they had 42 parties at the last election. If you can't make a demonstration of what democracy can do in Greece, then we haven't anything to offer to the rest of the world. And believe me, we haven't made a demonstration of what democracy can do in Greece, because we haven't had any program. We haven't had a counter-revolution. We haven't had anything that could offer to those people something better than what communism has had. We've helped to beat communism back. We've pushed it back, but only because Greece was so small that we didn't have to count the cost of doing that. We spent, since the war, just taking overall, the expenditure in Greece has been something like $2 billion for 7.5 million people. And if we'd spent money at the same rate on the same program in China in proportion to its population, we would have spent $100 billion to have achieved the same result. And what is the result? Well, we recognize today in Greece that as far as the government is concerned, we are no better off than when we started. And unless you get a better government that is more concerned with the people and their future, it'll be possible again for the communists to come in as they did before and stir up a civil war. With the aid which communism offers these people and the promise that that civil war will throw out their leaders and give them something better in place of it. Skye's Beach says further on, and that I'm not going to read to you, but he said, a great many people, not communists, think that it is too late to stop communism in Asia. We see where we have gotten, and we've gotten bogged down by admission of our general now. It's a stalemate in Korea. They haven't started to move into Indochina, but when they do, there isn't very much hope that we can stop them there. And so it goes. It's a very bleak picture. And unless we come up with some program, unless we have some evidence that there is leadership, which we haven't yet had, that we can produce some kind of a program, some kind of a spirit that can move against communism, then it may be true that we are on the way out. It may be true that as we look at Arnold Toynbee's great review of the pattern of history, of the rise and fall of civilizations, that the United States has reached its zenith and is on the way out as a vigorous younger nation is coming up and moving into a place of dominance. Well, Mr. Toynbee doesn't necessarily think so. For speaking a few months ago out on the Pacific coast, he made some significant statements which indicate, however, that the United States and the Western countries have got to do something if we are going to keep in the position which we now occupy, if we are going to save ourselves. He said, how can the Western nations successfully combat communism unless they establish an active working Christianity? That's the ideology that we may hope to fight successfully against communism. The West must learn to fight by a more intense practice of individual Christian living. If we're to fight Russia on equal terms, we must make our faith clear in our behavior. Probably the best book that has been written, a short summary of the problems, the economic problems of Europe, was written by a young lady, Barbara Ward, 36 years of age, an editor of the London Economist. You may be familiar with some of her writings. A new book has just come out. This is the previous book entitled The West at Bay. And after 228 pages of discussion of the economic problems of Europe, she comes down to her conclusions. They are not economic conclusions. She says that unless there is a revival of those things of the great spirit which build up our Western civilization, we cannot hope to survive. Let me read you a sentence or two from her closing chapters.